You have to make now
listen,
everyone amazing.
I talked to my advisors and they're telling us everybody must fuck. Everyone, no exceptions, must fuck.
Lather up. Folks, get fucked. Get deep down. Get deep down, folks. It's the only way. You're not going to get rid of the COVID unless you get your back walls blown open.
You have to hit the back wall.
You got
to
hit the back wall.
You know, in China, they're not hitting the back walls, and you see what's going on there. Yeah, it's a real problem.
Have to get
you
got to
hit
guts.
The back walls.
Okay. Are we going? Okay, we're on. Hello, everybody. It's Rachapo. We're back. Pleased to, share with you our bravery of continuing to do the podcast.
Still podcasting in the face of the apocalypse.
And, you know, like we are in one of the, you know, few sectors of the economy that is not only resistant to quarantine, but in fact will thrive under these
Absolutely.
Conditions.
Absolutely. I fucking hope so.
Is just, you know, indoors with nothing to do.
Nothing to do but listen to some pods.
We are, you know, we're risking our lives to, and probably, you know, and the lives of others too.
Of course.
To bring you content that will keep you entertained.
I barreled through a pod of retirees on the street earlier today, bowled them over like bowling pins. Probably gave all of them the COVID, but it was all for you people.
We're keeping the pods coming. You know what I'm saying? This is like, you know, we're like the brave captain of the Titanic who was like, keep playing those songs.
Yep.
Yo, hand me that aux cord, yo.
It's also like,
hand me that aux cord.
It's also like Silvio in The Sopranos when he's like, recession-proof businesses, certain aspects of show business and our thing.
Yeah.
That's pod.
Yeah, and podcasting, that's it. Yep. So it's Matt and I today, but luckily we are joined by Chapo made man, Brendan James.
Thank you. Hello.
And Chapo associate, Noah Coleman.
Howdy.
So,
you're the Meyer Lansky, if you will.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Why am I the Meyer Lansky?
I'm just
Brendan?
Pulling it out of the hat.
Okay.
Do you want to be him?
Yeah, I'm fine with
nothing
that.
Specific.
So, yeah, speaking of podcasts, of course, Brendan and Noah in a little bit will be telling us about a new podcast project that they are have just launched that will keep you entertained and informed during these dark times, and then keep you informed about a prior disaster in American history that people have largely forgotten now. Mm-hmm. He's talking, of course, about the Iraq War.
Yeah, we have a new show. It's about the Iraq War. It's called Blowback. Noah and I have been working on it for a couple months. We're excited for everyone to hear it. It's going to be in your Chapo feed. Probably as you're done listening to this. So check it out. There's like a taster episode. But the rest of it is on Stitcher Premium. So if you want to listen to it, sign up. You get a month free with the code BLOWBACK. One word. Caps don't matter. And we hope to see you on the other side.
And remember that these podcast episodes can be bartered for canned goods, shotgun shells.
Absolutely.
Anything you're going to need in the apocalypse.
They're actually more valuable because they're premium episodes.
Yeah, the Chapo script will be coming out soon.
Yeah.
Well, before we get there, let's talk about recent current events. And I'm speaking, of course, about last night's Democratic debate, 1v1, Biden-Sanders. We streamed the debate last night from our new stream studio. Matt was in full Joker makeup.
I was
Joker
time.
Yeah.
Romero style with the makeup over the
only
beard.
Way to go.
Yep.
Respect.
But you know, okay, let's just start it out. What were you, Noah, Brendan, I assume you watched the debate or at least read about it.
I didn't.
Okay. Well, what were your perceptions of the debate? How, what do you think? How can it be summed up?
I think I would sum it up as, I would love to know why Joe Biden seemed so perky last night.
Oh, seriously.
He was so much
he
more
was
together.
He was way more on the ball than usual.
Like it was, that was noticeable to me. That was the first takeaway. And the second, I think, was just that it seemed like it was the moment at which all things were laid bare and Biden was like repeatedly asked, you know, true or false questions about his own record and his past. And he answered falsely several times. And it was pretty jarring television. I'll say that.
I got to say, I think Trump really has, in a way that people maybe not even fully grasp, changed the game. Just maybe by virtue of the fact that things happen so fast now. I mean, and the fact that this is happening during a unprecedented, public health crisis and concomitant economic collapse. Mm. Somebody told him, just like, yeah, just say whatever you want. Don't matter. It doesn't matter. If he says you wanted to cut Social Security, just say, no, I didn't. Yeah. What are they going to do?
Yeah.
And it's not like the fucking the moderators are going to say anything about it, which they did not, even though these are not opinions. This is objective historical record. And I mean, I'm old enough to remember the 2012 presidential debate between Romney and Barf Sacco Crumbo, when Romney said something about Benghazi and Barf Sack said, that's not true. And he appealed to the moderator, and Candy Crowley just said, yeah, governor, but Barf Sack is correct.
Right.
None of that happened last night.
Instead,
they just said, actually, one time you said you wanted to adjust Social Security, Sanders. So does that mean this is basically all just a he said, she said anyway?
No, it was a he said, she said, because they were like, it was funny. It was interesting. The moderators came prepared with individual instances from Bernie's record that they were willing to bring up and call him on. But strangely, they didn't seem to do that for Joe Biden at all. And when it came to the Social Security issue, they brought up, they were like, well, yeah, didn't you, Mr. Sanders, like, didn't you, try to adjust Social Security just like Joe Biden did? And it was like, yeah, you dumb asshole. I tried to expand it, not cut it.
And I will say, and make the Social Security Trust Fund more long-term viable by removing the cap on contributions, which a lot of people probably don't know that. A lot of people don't know that you only get taxed for Social Security on the first $200,000 of income. Mm-hmm. So anybody who makes more than that, they're not paying any payroll taxes towards Social Security. And one of the things Bernie wanted to do is get rid of that, which would, by the way, obliterate basically forever the worry about it being unsustainable or whatever horseshit they like to
cut it. But then if you remove that cap, though, then the Ponzi scheme won't work.
Yeah.
It's Social Security is a Ponzi scheme.
Right.
This is what it is,
Ponzi scheme. And like all Ponzi schemes, every working person is required to contribute to it. Yeah. Right. That's how they all work.
One thing that showed up last night in the debate that I've thought a lot about is sort of like the question of like, to what extent is the corporate media affecting like the actual race as it proceeds? And one of the, I think, kind of layups that they handed to Biden last night, at least in terms of like how the pundits were spinning it, was this idea that like, well, you know, Bernie's talking about a revolution and Biden's talking about dealing with the crisis as it is, as if what Biden was saying had, you know, any relationship to reality on an effective way to deal with the crisis as it is right now. But it was like this false distinction where they were like able to once again paint Bernie as like somebody totally unable to deal with the challenges of this very moment, when in fact it's quite obvious which one of them could possibly do that.
Well, here's the interesting thing is like the whole first half hour of the debate, of course, was just all about coronavirus and pandemic. And, you know, like, well, you know, what are you going to do? Like, what could you do right now if you were president to, like, you know, assuage people's fears or help them get treatment? And the interesting dichotomy was that, like, Matt, you pointed that out when we were watching it. Like, Biden was just saying, like, listen, Mac, like, we're gonna get you the treatment you need free of cost. We're going to take care of you. But it was like all within the paradigm of this pandemic is like as soon as it goes away, like if you have breast cancer or something, oh, no, you'll still be bankrupted by health insurance bills.
Yeah.
Right. So he's just like he just wanted to like stress the point that all of these things are only contingent on a pandemic.
Yeah.
And don't get used to it because like we shouldn't create expectations going forward in the future about what you can't should or shouldn't expect from our healthcare system.
And by implication, anything Bernie is offering is going to shake things up too much. And what you want right now is stability. I want everything to go back to normal impulse times 1,000. And so Biden can just sound as though he wants to make the right tweaks, get a competent person in there. So the Mucinex guy, I know the Mucinex monster. I'm the guy who's trying to lock him up. I've been trying to lock up the Mucinex monster. The whole thing we were trying to do. And then people go, oh, okay. I mean, Bernie's going to probably, rock the boat too much. So I'm going to stick with Joe.
I do wish that Bernie had more actual blue sky, big idea shit, you know, when talking about how to respond to Corona, because Biden was just able to say, I want to do the same thing, but just for a shorter period of time.
He was also able to say, like, I want to go to war with the virus.
Well, right, because that's like, the only vocabulary
like,
they have.
Like the fucking general from Mars Attacks.
I heard Bernie wasn't mean enough. You know, I mean, you were texting me, like, he's landing some blows, but that he should have been basically 100% or 50%.
Well, yeah, I mean,
the thing is, though.
Is that just us? We want that?
But the thing is like, we want that, yes. We have no idea what it affects. But honestly, I don't think really any of us have absorbed just how maybe none of at this point, like we've been going through this whole campaign with a certain expectations and like of, you know, where things are going to be, what strategy should be, all that kind of stuff. And then, you know, the Biden consolidated against Bernie, and that created a new paradigm. And now we're like, well, what to do with this? But now with the fucking corona, I don't know if any of this is registering at all mm-hmm. in any sense. I honestly feel like the election isn't happening in mm-hmm. in a meaningful, in like people aren't thinking of it. This is unprecedented. I mean, they close everything today. Everything's closed.
Do you think that they should shut down the primaries?
Well, of course they should. And that's what's amazing is you've got people blue check fucking people like Neera Tanden saying in one breath, make sure that you're stay safe and stay quarantined and don't go out. And then, wow, Bernie says we shouldn't have a primary. It's a way to suppress elections. That's messed up of you.
I mean, I think
we should definitely be herding old people into fucking church basements and gymnasiums to fucking cough in each other's faces for 4 hours.
And
just pure death cult insanity.
And like the thing is, like I think what we see from the media and certainly like the reaction like a day after is like since Super Tuesday on, it's just like they want this to be over with, and they are acting accordingly in that like it is already over, and they're just like they're pissed off that they even have to cover this or that there even was a debate in the first place that they are now expected to like, adjudicate the claims made in. And we were watching it last night, and I was like, look, I would have liked to see Joe Biden get his fucking throat slit, metaphorically speaking, on national television.
Parody.
I would have liked Bernie to like really fucking stick the knife in or just made him
satire
seem, you know, like the babbling Daffy Moon babble that, you know, he's known for. Or just get him angry, which he did at a certain point. Mm-hmm. And like I was like, well, at the end of the day, like Bernie did force Joe Biden into probably a half dozen absolutely glaring bald-faced lies about his record. And I was like, well, okay, maybe that's something. Maybe someone will pick up on that. And the answer is, at least I don't know what I was thinking at the time, nobody has other than the Sanders campaign or people who are dedicated Sanders partisans. Because like everyone in the media universally declared Biden the winner of that debate. And we're basically like, that's over. Like, you know, like this is the last gasp of Bernie Sanders, the wacky old man. You know, like this is the last we'll ever have to deal with or talk about him. And it's just like they don't believe that it's even their job to just simply state whether what Joe Biden said about his record on cutting Social Security and Medicaid last night is even their purview.
Well, they'll bring it back up during the general whenever
they
that
will.
Happens.
That's the thing.
They'll
bring it back up.
They'll have some nice archival footage to go. You said this. There's someone asked you about this. Maybe an audience member or maybe someone.
Are you saying that Bernie should have dropped out and that he shouldn't have given this vital ammunition to Donald Trump or whatever?
Yeah. I'm saying Bernie don't run in all caps on a certain website.
And, you know, like to me, like the comment of the night that sums it up better for me than almost anything else was Joy Ann Reid last night, live tweeting the debate, said that, like, at this point, like, does anybody actually care what two career politicians said or did 20, 35 years ago? And it's just like, well, that's it. You know, like, your job is to cover politics and, like, offer your opinions on it to, like, your audience of fucking loyal listeners or people who want to be informed about the world. And you're just saying, who cares?
Yeah.
Who cares? Like, hey,
hashtag who
cares? Yeah. Like who cares what Joe Biden even did 5 years ago?
Yeah.
And it's just like, well, this is the thing. Whether it's Social Security or the Iraq War, we've just decided none of it matters.
She is a third mic on our new show. Before we get too deep into this, slamming her. Well, also, I think the Roni is going to like soften Trump up in the general, obviously, with, as you said, a corollary economic collapse, so everyone's feeling just as sure as ever that Biden will coast in, but that means that yes, they want to wrap it up all the quicker.
I mean, also though, like look at what's happening in Congress now, where it's like, you know, like the thing being bandied about today is this, like, you know, you have like Tom Cotton talking about like we got to give cash to like every American or whatever, and it's like
Romney too,
it's like an insane fail, like. You know, it's not really like a misfire of the Democrats because they're engineered to lose and their will is to lose. But it is really striking how quickly like the Republicans are the ones with like a bold-faced policy proposal about like cash in every pocket. And like Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer's, you know, they're putting out their own proposal, I guess. But just like getting beaten to the punch like this and just like it's I mean, it would be embarrassing if it wasn't, like, again, by design.
And yeah, share, well, yeah, at what point do you have to include that it absolutely is by design,
yeah,
and not just, like, a flaw of their, that they're just so, like, disciplined and conditioned?
Democrat Sherrod Brown has come forward also saying, yes, we need cash, but it should be means tested.
Mm-hmm.
So he is also bidding to the right of the opening Republican bid on a fucking temporary UBI. I mean, that's why this is, I mean, we've been talking about how we're in uncharted territory. One of the things that might come out of this is a thing people have talked about for years. The evidence has mostly been rhetorical, but you know, the possibility always existed that the Republicans run to the left,
mm-hmm,
in this, like, a broad populist way. Like, they do, like, a war communism type response to this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the Democrats spend the whole time kicking and screaming and trying to, like, means test it and cut
talk
it down from the right
issues.
Yeah. And become essentially obsolete.
Yeah,
I mean, yeah,
and that's and we get essentially a one-party state where the Republicans are divided between the racist neoliberals and the racist National Socialists.
Yeah,
and the Democrats are the Whigs or something.
Yeah,
and that's what'll happen if no meaningful left force can fill the gigantic gap right now left by a party that is completely in denial. Determined to anoint this just senile fossil to the presidency, and to continue to be seen as ineffectual, penny-pinching dipshits in Congress. And there's no one to stop it. I mean, the Bernie campaign, we talk about how this is, like, he's being vindicated in everything he's ever said, and yet it's not translating into anyone making those connections. Because I don't think we can make those connections anymore in any social why. There's no common experience for us to compare notes across. So there's no way for us to all, like, have that moment of, wow. What, like I said, I think, like, 2008 and the response to that and the Obama campaign, I think it kind of broke that. I don't know if we can ever do that again. And so there needs to be a concerted left effort here to provide an alternative to what's coming, but there's no structure for it. And the Bernie campaign was supposed to be the first step in creating a structure and providing, you know, a breeding ground for left organizing. And but, you know, we were supposed to have a little bit of time before this sort of extreme crisis happened. It's a little early, so there's just nothing on the ground to do anything about it.
And, you know, I was reading my favorite online news website, Vox.com, this
sure
morning. And one of the Vox boys interviewed Megan Day. And, like, the entire, you know, concept of the interview is that, like, wow, Bernie Sanders is over. Will you admit now that you were wrong and that Bernie Sanders was wrong? And then, like, the overall tone of it is that obviously Vox has been 100% against Bernie Sanders from the very beginning, right? But they're like, why can't you just admit that, you know, voters just aren't buying what Bernie Sanders is selling? And will you take any responsibility for that? And that, like, do you think maybe if he, you know, were more like me or, like, catered more to our, like, you know, policy prescriptions and worldview, the voters would like him better? Which is hilarious because, like, Elizabeth Warren is, like, the perfect test case for that.
She ate shit.
Absolutely. Not a single person bought her, whereas Bernie Sanders, let's be honest, was the front runner up until a couple weeks ago and is still basically kind of toe-to-toe with the entire apparatus of the Democratic Party.
I mean, he still beats Biden on, like, fairly, like, when put head-to-head on, like, fairly key questions of, like, who is a better person,
and the
who
way
will do things.
And
that
the way
I
they frame it is he's like, you know, like, I see socialists, like, often blame the media for, like, why, like, Bernie Sanders, like, the voters' perceptions of Bernie Sanders, like, doesn't matter, like, match, you know, their own. And what he said was, like, look, I'd be lying if I said the media didn't massively influence voters' perceptions of politics and reality. But now that we've done our job, you need to wrestle with the fact of, like, why that's the case. But it's not our fault. And, like, a perfect example of that is that, like, in the same interview, he's like, look, well, yeah, you know, polls are unreliable and voters are ideologically incoherent and can be prompted one way or another to say, like, oh, we should have a safe choice or versus, like, we need to fundamentally change the economy. But, like, you know, on issue by issue, like Medicare for All is a perfect example of that. Overwhelmingly, Democratic voters and all voters are in favor of it. But they also think that Joe Biden is for Medicare for All.
Right.
And, like, the media just think, like, they're just like, oh, well, that just happened. You know, well, why is that the case? Did we do that? Like, certainly not. Like, they just believe that for some reason.
when it's just like, no, like they do exist to manage and discipline like the parameters of what is possible and what it can be believed among voters, right? And like, it's just like there's a big did I do that thing that I'm getting from a lot of these people where it's just like they say in one breath, well, like obviously we influence everything about like what people believe and how they perceive reality. But then once we've done our job, it's like it's your fault now, or you have to deal with that fact and like also not blame us, because then that's like you're shirking responsibility or something like that. Right.
Well, they rely on the idea that they're simply a prism, you know, that they're just a, if anything, like kind of filter through which people get facts that they interpret and they represent, but that ultimately they don't change in any meaningful way or contaminate in any meaningful way. And so their responsibility for any misperceptions still lie on behalf of the Sanders campaign, the left, whatever. And that I'm sure they believe that in their head. And so, yeah, why would they think they hold any responsibility?
There's a guy I think about, Ben Bagdikian, who was an editor at the Washington Post years ago, was later the dean of Berkeley J School. He's played by Bob Odenkirk.
Yes.
In the Post.
The Steven Spielberg movie, right?
The Post. And Bagdikian, was a big proponent of like the idea that the biggest blind spot in American journalism is like capitalism and specifically the role that the media industry or the news media industry plays within capitalism, like as such, in terms of like enforce, like in terms of its business model and how it's meant to enforce those kinds of ideas. And it's like kind of wild to think that like the conversation and the like degree to which like that observation has just not sunk in for like, you know, like 50 years, 60 years, like, you know, there's been no there's been no evolution in thought about that, and we're still dealing with like the same like simplistic attitude, and it's like gotta take, like, I mean, I have no idea what could crack it.
Well, journalism has also been reduced to, you know, it's hanging by a thread, is that the business models are all dying or dead, and the consolidation has happened, you know, quicker than I think everyone thought. And so you have this atomization of what the way people get media, and then just a few giants up top who all think and want the same stuff. So journalism is, I mean, it's much worse than it was probably even at that time.
And we also don't, you know, we like should, could like give money to like make journalism happen. The state can do that. Other countries do it.
Yeah.
It's just that like we of course,
yeah,
we
like
don't.
The Kremlin. You want to do?
I want American RT. Absolutely.
Yeah. It's just,
It's just like I think on some level they must be aware that the media in this country, outside of, I don't know, Democracy Now, Jacobin, and this show, is top to bottom universally hostile to Bernie Sanders and everything he stands for, and will in every single way poison the well in terms of the way they cover him or just not cover him. And then, like, now that they've done that, they're just saying, well, oh, like, you have to deal with that, or, like, we won't even admit to it.
I mean, there's something to it in the sense that that was always the reality that needed to be confronted, and complaining about it doesn't really change it. You had to have a plan, and they did. The Sanders campaign has had a plan to try to overcome the media hostility. It just didn't work, and, I mean, it's very disingenuous for the Vox motherfuckers to act like they are not largely responsible, but there does have to be a real question, a search and for the answers to why the specific reasons that the mobilization strategy for the Sanders campaign did not bear the fruit that it needed to.
Yeah.
I mean, well, like I said before, I mean, like it bore a lot of fruit. I mean, it's sort of like the question is,
oh, no, yes.
For me,
it's just
like,
that it needed to do more, and it always did, and it didn't. And we need to reckon with why.
Well,
and we need to reckon with it pretty fucking quick, because we're entering a new territory now we've all been saying, no one knows it's going to happen, but I mean, talk about a fucking crisis of legitimacy, you know, in basically every sector and institution we have. And how are we going to respond to it? Like, I mean, in a situation where we're seeing every single politician and political institution show itself to be completely incapable of dealing with the moment, what is the only institution in this country that people actually trust and respect and give any kind of faith in?
Their podcasts.
Yes. There's one other one. Does anyone want?
Can the military.
Yes, yeah. That's the one.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know where this ends up, but I just know that the political sphere seems to be shrinking very, very quickly.
Well, if you want to talk about a crisis of legitimacy, at least as far as like, our two political parties that we are offered in this country, just back to this, the Pelosi's paid sick leave bill, where they're just like, they could have passed, like, it does not take supermajority. Like, they control the House of Representatives. And then with the position they started from is something that will exclude 80% of all workers from getting paid sick leave. And they're like, yep, we've done paid sick leave now. Time to dust off the hands, comically. And it's just like, yeah, vote blue no matter who, right?
Yep.
This is what we're voting for?
Coughing directly into each other's mouths.
Yep.
Yeah, again, I don't know what you say about that, but like, you should keep that in mind when people just tell you that, like, it's your moral duty and, like, you know, to vote for the Democratic Party, vote for Joe Biden in the general election if he's the nominee. If he doesn't,
it's just like, it just feels more and more like as the crisis deepens and as more radical steps are being considered, the Democratic Party will be less and less relevant as an institution to that process. You know what I mean? I mean, and they're doing it on purpose because they want to abdicate their responsibility because,
yes,
because my God, I mean, they don't want to do what they say they want to do in the best of times. They sure as shit wouldn't want to do what they're claiming to want to do during the, with the mandate and sort of accelerated timetable and loosened restraints of a significant social crisis.
And that desire to continue to fundraise while President Cheeto is in power or some Republican, and they'll look good by definition in comparison. Oh, we wish we were in there, you know, but we're not. At least keep giving us money.
So we're going to let the Republicans do things like give everybody money and suspend rent.
And then when
we do reestablish elections, if that ever fucking happens, they're going to be like, we're the guys who kept your lights on and kept you from getting evicted when you're fucking hiding out where you were hiding from the coronavirus.
Yeah.
While fucking Nancy Pelosi was and Steny Hoyer and shit were talking about, like, well, how can we make sure that this is means tested so it doesn't go to people who don't deserve it?
But they may not realize, of course, that that could push them into the historical obsolete category of also ran party. I think they're hoping it keeps them as, you know, to that perfectly placed kind of grift loyal opposition thing. But as you say, it could actually just sort of evaporate any efficacy of the Democratic Party to ever come back.
And like Biden's success, I think, for a lot of them is just being taken as proof that, like, hey, the thing works. Like, you know, it's like a fairly, the fact that he was able to, you know, with an enormous amount of assistance, like,
it was the Pulp Fiction heart chest cavity pump.
The adrenaline thing.
Yeah,
they just shoved a vial full of Pete and Amy and Bloomberg. You know,
and literal adrenaline. Don't forget that.
And actual adrenaline.
Because I guarantee you, before that debate, they did an actual reenactment of that scene.
into his chest. And that is what took him back to frontrunner status. It wasn't him.
Yeah.
He was just wandering around. But they look at it now, either with the real brains look at it cynically, but I'm sure a lot of people look at it and go, yeah, Joe had it. He was down for a bit.
Or they look at it the other way, which is that it's like, well, Joe, like the people wanted Joe, and the voters that's like that is what they go to. And it's like, oh shit, they're interpreting this as like a Democratic mandate to, like, you know, do like means tested like mortgage tax credits or something.
Yeah, I'm like, not going to pretend to know whether or not there was that Bernie only had a plurality because of, I mean, obviously the number of candidates was a huge factor, but let's say we got beyond that. I don't know whether it was just a push, like you blow and it just sort of all would have fallen over and electability, conceptions of electability was the only thing, or maybe there was more work to be done, you know, and that people still needed to be won over, but we're never going to know now because the way that they marshaled that just hive mind Zergling rush of Pete, Amy, you know, Bloomberg support obliterated the entire problem for them.
Well, I would actually say that coronavirus is the Zerg, mm-hmm. and that I think they were like beset upon by
Felix isn't here, so no one else is going to be able to jump into this stupid video game bullshit.
It definitely makes you think that, it makes me suspect anyway, that if Biden had been stronger from the get-go, if he had more of trust of high-level donors and politicians, if he had more of an actual network of supporters and like genuine clients within the Democratic Party from the beginning, that he would have kept a lot of these knuckleheads from running in the first place.
Sure.
And in that situation, I don't know if Bernie ever would have looked like a front runner, even for a minute.
All right. Well, like I said, back to the debate itself and like Biden's litany of just bald-faced lies. And I think, like, well, there's two things. There's one that I think is hilarious is that just yesterday he announced, like, yeah, like, listen, Mac, like, I'm adopting Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, part of their free college tuition program, where it's just like, that's the thing. He's going to be like, hey,
take this, dummies. Like, hey, like, yeah, well, I'll give you, this is a scrap. Oh, yeah. I'll throw you. And by the way, I'm sure he'll vigorously pursue this admirable policy.
Just like Obama did with card check.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Did you guys talk about the leaked thing of who would be in his cabinet or whatever?
Oh, yeah. Well, he's like, yeah, Jamie Dimon. Yeah,
Jamie Dimon and Elizabeth Warren.
Or Elizabeth Warren for Treasury Secretary, which is hysterical.
Yeah.
No, that, though, is like one of those great examples of just like who knows what the fuck to think about that, because I do love this. Like, that is like the most like drunk throwing darts at a wall shit
ever. Like, Teacots used to tweet, like, health secretary, Ben Carson, Treasury, Mitt Romney, because he did business.
Yeah, David Clark, Homeland Security.
Chief cop person, you know, and it was just this infant's idea of like names you attach to jobs. And then the Biden thing was just, honestly, points for honesty. It was just like bankers and then Liz Warren, even though she's supposed to hate bankers, but they'll work together under a Biden administration.
Also, how they're going to pass that, you know? They never tell you how they're going to get it done. How are you going to get it through the Senate?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's amazing. That is the funniest shit in the world, is that Biden shit is subject to every single question about procedure that Bernie's is, because the Republicans are no more likely to pass Biden care than single payer. 0%. You get as many Republican votes for Biden care as you would for
public option.
Well, no, but this leads you to the actual problem that they will never talk about, which is that what they're really discussing when they're going over like that hemming and hawing over what's possible is actually over, can you even get Democrats to vote for it? Like,
yes.
Will Joe fucking Manchin vote for this bill?
Yes.
Like, that's the negotiation that they're making like internally. And it's just like, it's psychotic.
Yeah.
It's a hostage. It's like arguing. It's like a crazy guy with like a mirror and a gun, like pointed at his head, like shouting, like don't make me do it. Don't make me do
it. Whiskey sours. Hey, fucking whiskey sours.
Get these lines right. I'm gonna blow your fucking brains out tonight. All right, your brains are gonna be splattered all over your goddamn pool. I mean it, motherfucker. Get your shit together.
Okay, there was another big one was Joe Biden's role in writing the bankruptcy bill.
Which he didn't do that.
He absolutely did not do it. No, what he said about that is like, look, the bill is going to get passed anyway, so that by writing it and voting for it, I managed to make it slightly less worse than it already was.
There you go. That is the Democratic pitch in the last 40 years condensed to one fucking sentence. It was going to be even worse if I wasn't there.
Right.
It would have been worse if I wasn't there.
And Bernie's response to that was like, well, you could have done what I did, which is vote against it and try to marshal support against this awful bill rather than being like, I'll write it. That way I'll write it and pass it.
Yeah.
It's so bad that I need to write it and pass it into law.
So I can prevent it from being even worse than it would have been.
That sounds familiar.
I mean, it's hard to imagine how that bankruptcy bill could have been even worse than it actually turned out as.
Listen here, Fat. he didn't write the bill. He didn't vote for it. He didn't ever say no he never said to cut Social Security. He didn't vote for the Iraq War. I don't know what you're talking about.
Also, the thing that
his name is Bernie Sanders, actually.
I'm the guy who's trying to beat Biden.
You guys remember the thing what he said about PolitiFact and how like...
Yeah, were you going to say like, PolitiFact's
the most incredible like ref begging, like just bullshit. Like that was a crazy how it was like... It was expected. That's media serving its purpose right there.
Yeah, yeah.
And quite explicitly.
When they got into that ref working and shit, because like obviously like the moderators were not going to call out anyone, or except not going to call out Biden, I should say.
Yeah.
Bernie Sanders would be like, oh, okay, all right, well, if you're watching this at home, go to the YouTube. Go to the YouTube. Go to the Google.
Yeah.
And then when Joe Biden would have to, like, you know, cite facts or sources, he'd be like, go to JoeBiden.com. Just check out JoeBiden.com. Fact check on JoeBiden.com. Go to the fact. Go to the frequently asked questions, Jack.
Go to the fat.
Go to the fat. Fact.
Listen, fact.
The fat fact.
Yeah.
Let's move into your new project, and like again, probably the number one thing that you know still to this day obsesses and fascinates me is the war in Iraq.
Well, we have an episode with Will, by the way. You're in it. You're in it too.
When they got into foreign policy, and Bernie Sanders is like, look, everyone who voted for that war authorization like knew it was you were giving Bush the go ahead to go to war. Biden's excuse or his response to that is basically he has said
I never believed Saddam had weapons of mass destruction. And I had to give Bush the authority to go to war to prove that Saddam, that he didn't have any.
That's what he said just the other day.
Lying.
Last year, he had a completely different explanation when challenged on it again, which is he said what people usually say, which is I was duped and that they tricked me. So he's gone from I was duped to no, I was actually playing 12th dimensional chess.
I was doing irony.
Where I, even though, you know, we all know this is false, I was trying to give them authorization so they could go into Iraq, 2003, by the way, this is the, or rather, the vote was 2002, October 2002, and there was a march to war. There was still a window there, though, where there could have been a real, an actual loyal opposition, if you want to use that phrase. The anti-war movement was starting to coalesce. Biden was, of course, an incredibly strong and solid supporter of the war and made it clear in his, like, three-hour-long speech when he voted for it. We had to rip a lot. I had to rip a lot of audio to, you know, drip it into the show. And Hillary Clinton, I'll give her this. When she voted for the war, she basically took about 10 minutes, said, you know, let's go in, got off the podium. Biden talked for, like, honestly, hours and hours and hours. And I just kept looking to see if the file was done yet, but he went on forever. And in it, he says, we have to dislodge. He has to dislodge his weapons or we will dislodge him. And then last year he says, well, I was duped. And then this year he says, no, I was trying to do a secret UN mission to defeat the Bush administration.
But it's exactly the same justification as for the bankruptcy bill. He was like, look, I knew the war was going to happen. Therefore, like, I should be a part of the war and have some say in how it's carried out. Not that, like, the very idea of carrying it out is an insane atrocity.
Correct.
And here's the thing that really drives me insane about this. Because, like, you know, Biden now, like 15, 20 years after the fact, has to say shit like, it was a mistake. And I admit that. And I've admitted it in the past. So stop asking me about it. And then he'll say, but listen, he said this on stage last night. The idea that, like, you know, Bernie Sanders has better foreign policy judgment than me. I'll have that debate anytime. Well, it's just like, okay, you're having that debate right now.
Yes.
You just gave the textbook example of how fatally poisoned your judgment is.
Yes.
And that, like, you helped kill a million innocent people for, like, no fucking reason. So, like, how can you admit that it was a mistake? And then, like, if you admit that you did that as a mistake, why are you running for president? And why are you even on TV? Why haven't you killed yourself in shame?
Not only that, and I think we probably want to use this episode. We talk about Joe Biden in the show. Joe Biden is one of the people that, you know, we discuss as far as his support for the war. And then once the war is underway, we can talk in a second about another horrible idea he had to fix it. But he was the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee during the Iraq War.
Yeah.
So this was not, he was not even some bystander. He had, if you really want to rank these things, one of the most important places in the Senate to genuinely view the evidence, to genuinely make a case to his colleagues about why it was a good idea or a bad idea.
And he was among the first people to get, you know, intelligence from all sorts of, like, dubious characters who we get into in our show, like Ahmed Chalabi, and, like,
Corn
all
Pop.
Of, like,
the darker side of the Corn Pop saga.
Yeah, it was Curveball and Corn Pop. Those were the two sources for most of the intel.
And, you know, German intelligence had already vetted Corn Pop and found him to be unreliable and a bike chain wielding thug.
He had like an enormous amount of insight into this and has just, like, obviously, as Brendan has said, just, like, painted himself as a bystander.
Yes. Now he does.
Yeah, now he does.
At the time, he was all too happy to say, I think this is a march to peace. I'm proud of what we're doing here. So, yeah, it is infuriating to watch any of that. And if you like, we should mention, once the war was underway, he came up with the idea around 2006, I believe, when a civil war was, I mean, Iraq became a butcher's slab. Courtesy of the United States, he came up with the idea of ethnically cleansing the three main factions in the country and carving it up British imperial style in real time to just make it three new countries, which is probably the only thing that would have made things even worse.
Yeah, it's like probably couldn't have come up with a worse plan in a lab.
Like, so he supported the war, and then when he wanted to end it, he wanted to do ethnic cleansing, which is, like, the worst position you could have.
And the other amazing thing he did at the debate last night to talk about the war in Iraq, he's like, yes, not only did I vote for it, but I was, like, a loud, loud cheerleader for the war. And not that, but, like, but also attacking anyone who questioned the wisdom of, you know, launching an invasion of Iraq. Yes. But then, like, to get out of that, he said, listen, the Obama administration, the Barack America administration, first thing he did when he came in there, he said, Joe, end the war.
Yeah.
And I did.
Yeah, yeah, you know? Saying, like, that. He was, like, he was put in charge of ending the war in Iraq. Which, I mean, whatever. I guess he knew all the fucking warlords and like disgusting Scarface type guys we were working with, maybe so he could whisper in their ear.
Also like the war in Iraq ended, and then what happened?
Yeah, well, we get into that as well. So the knock on effects from good old Joe's decisions every step of the way.
Joe's still folly.
Yes.
But like, you know, again, like, and you guys have like done a shitload of research into this, and like, again, this is really not that long ago.
No.
No.
But like, it seems like it was a million years ago, the way people talk about it, or like, but like, how, like, you're like, how does like the war on terror, but the Iraq war specifically, like, how is that like kind of the emperor of all maladies of like the 21st century American imperial collapse and rot?
Sure. Well, the most important thing is what we did to Iraq and the Iraqi people. Obviously, that's front and center. You can look at the utter destruction of a country, both. Through whether it be, and we actually really want to emphasize this in the show, we have a whole episode on the Gulf War before we even get to the Iraq War, the sanctions throughout the 90s, the incredibly punitive and the psychotic intentional destruction of Iraqi infrastructure and particularly their electrical grid, which purified their water, a huge outbreak of disease accompanied the sanctions that killed hundreds of thousands of people. That softened Iraq up for the Iraq War to be as bad as it was. And that was the noble statesman George H.W. Bush, not his cowboy Yosemite Sam son. H.W. gets often a free pass in saying he did it the right way. And W. was this messy, you know, black sheep of the family who came along and fucked it all up. But the invasion itself, the 90s, and then, of course, the actual carnage that rolled out, destroyed a nation. That's one thing and is good enough to do a show on in general. But also at home, this is where we invent the Department of Homeland Security, ICE, comes out of the war on terror, and more than that, the actual gearing up to treat this as a civilizational conflict that involves Iraq. The deficit in any kind of trust in government, WMDs being the linchpin of the case and being revealed to have been false. When Trump got up there in 2016 and effectively ran against the Iraq war, especially when he was running against Jeb Bush, all these hogs in the audience who would have told you a couple months earlier, I still think they're in Syria personally, the WMD, they immediately dropped all that. They didn't give a shit. They just saw a strongman who was willing to exploit brilliantly that deficit of trust within their own party, let alone the government at large, and run away with it. And he was a steamroller at that point. Once you saw a Republican running against the Iraq war and against anyone who was associated with it as like cuck, neocon, like untrustworthy creeps, he was on his way. I mean, that was it.
And then running in a general election against Hillary Clinton, a candidate who also supported the Iraq war.
And supported it, no matter what they like to say now. She also supported it throughout the execution of the war. And we don't do this in the show per se, but I interviewed Cindy Sheehan a couple years ago. And she said, I was trying to meet with Hillary like deep into, like almost near the 2008 election. And she canceled a meeting with me and the anti-war moms. She went over and she did an event with the pro-war moms to prove that she was still representing, you know, the families who fight our wars. And that was, you know, way after the initial psychosis that got us into Iraq. So all these people that we still live with, these institutions and the NSA, name it, you know, ICE, the NSA, the National Security State, given a huge shot in the arm at that time by Democrats and Republicans. And then, of course, the violence in Iraq that gave way to a proxy war between Iraq and Iran that is constantly exploited, and that Trump obviously, you know, made his mark on a couple months ago. All this shit we still live with, and it wasn't that long ago. And we want to take a look at exactly how we got there so that next time you see a headline or a tweet or whatever, you know where some of this stuff actually comes from.
And the other thing that's amazing to me about this is that, like, after Trump kicked open the door, and certainly now in the Democratic primary, like at every single level in American politics, like a national level, there is, or even a local level, there is nobody who is running as like a proud defender of the war in Iraq. It is universally acknowledged, like, after, again, and at the time it was going on, I never thought this would have ever happened, because like the top to bottom, the media, the political class, at every level of authority in this country, from the New York Times, the New Yorker, like every level of like liberal institutional authority, certainly conservative media outlets, was four square in favor of the war in Iraq. And to be against it was just simply a not serious position to hold. That if it would instantly mark you as an outsider, or like, I cannot stress, if you were too young at the time,
just how marginal and insane you were made to feel for being against the Iraq war, not as like a tactical mistake or that it was badly prosecuted or incompetently done, but like the concept of it itself is an atrocity. It was a needless, unnecessary war that was sold to the American people on lies, on straight up, not things that were misstatements or false,
yes,
self-conscious lies.
Yes.
Like the people who did it did this on purpose and they knew the things that we're saying were not true.
Yes.
They were false. Basically, everyone accepts that at some level or another now. But even like, especially among liberals, like when, again, faced with the prospect of Joe Biden being the Democratic nominee or Hillary Clinton before him, they basically look at it like, yes, voting to authorize the Iraq war and give George W. Bush the authority to start one of the most disastrous wars in American history, that was a mistake. But it's a mistake on par with, like, I don't know, voting not to raise interest rates or just like,
sure,
it's just like some weird, like, technocratic, like a parking ticket violation.
Well,
basically.
I mean, one of the things that in the process of making the show that I think Brendan and I both found was that there was like an incredibly, like, the amount of distance that the military and the Pentagon bureaucracy and the Bush White House sought to put between what was happening on the ground and how they characterized it and were in denial about it. Like, I think that partly like contributes to that kind of amnesia and to the, like, why people are able, because they, you know, they weren't, even if they knew at the time, they want to forget now, like, you know, that we used, for instance, like radioactive material when fighting, you know, insurgents in Fallujah.
There was a forced labor system designed for Fallujah. You know, I don't think a lot of people know that. I don't think a lot of people know this kind of stuff. And I'm sure that Joe Biden fucking knew it, but he didn't.
Wait,
care.
I don't know about this. What is this?
In Fallujah, after, so 2004, one of the most, you know, horrifying set pieces of the war, it was a stronghold of Sunni insurgents.
Well, yeah, I mean, just to point out a second, like, yeah, every time you hear about a battle like that as a set piece, I mean, it's already like, you know, really just some like a bit of American theater.
Yeah, I'm using the running dog terminology, but yes, and it was a stronghold for quote unquote insurgents, which
why
we
was that? What happened in Fallujah right after the invasion that might have led that to happen?
The idea, of course, throughout the entire war was that the insurgents were all Al Qaeda, you know,
foreign fighters.
Could not stress this enough. Coming from Syria and other bad places, led by Zarqawi, who was a guy that, funnily enough, we had said was Al Qaeda in Iraq, but for all intents and purposes was just some asshole. But then when we invaded, he became and seized the day and said, well, now I can actually exploit this vacuum and get a bunch of guys on my side. And he actually did become Al-Qaeda in Iraq. But that was still a very, very small portion of the insurgency. Most of them were nationalists who just wanted us fucking out. Fallujah was a stronghold in a largely Sunni part of the country in which they had been completely disenfranchised and, you know, raids happening in their homes.
Well, there was the big massacres, remember?
Yes.
Right?
Do you want to speak on it?
Shortly after the invasion, there was a big protest in front of an American military base, and the U.S. military guys just opened fire on them and killed a bunch of them.
And
that, like, set the tone for their response to everything that came after.
There was a sense among the Sunnis in Iraq that, you know, especially because they had been, you know, Saddam was a Sunni clique regime, and all of a sudden they were pushed out of any meaningful participation or, like, future of Iraq. So you had all these things boiling over that resulted in a clear insurgency. And when Fallujah blew up, or rather when we blew it up, I mean, millions or hundreds of thousands of people fled the city. It became rubble, much like people think of Aleppo or whatever today,
yeah,
and the liberal guilt over, you know, Syria. This was not applied to a place that we were doing that to in Fallujah. But once people came back, the males were conscripted into a, it was forced labor. It was, I mean, you were paid, whatever that fucking meant in the middle of the Iraq Civil War, to rebuild the rubble that we made sure was on the ground, and that there, I think cars were also banned. People had like papers with them at all times, like, you know, I mean, just Nazi shit that we were doing in this country, particularly, you know, in one specific part of the country, but not the only place. And so I don't think a lot of people know this stuff. And as far as, you know, to bring it back to Biden and the intelligence going in or the intelligence that was coming out of the country, everyone knew that the war was already in motion in 2002. Tommy Franks and Rumsfeld had started drawing up the plans in November 2001 when Bush told Rumsfeld to start looking at options for Iraq. So the idea that the Senate Foreign Relations chair didn't know that this was not going to be an inspection, this was not going to be a knock on the door, it was going to be at the end of the day, an excuse for a full-fledged invasion and occupation is bullshit. And Biden knew it. And this is now scrubbed from all of our memories because, as you say, even the moderators go, wasn't that a bit of a blunder? It wasn't a blunder. We all knew it was going, or they all knew it was going to happen. And they were happy to support it.
Or, like, if you say, like, okay, like I said, like, to get back to my original point, it's like, if you're able to admit that the war is a mistake because you essentially have to at this point, then what you're actually saying is what, you know, I knew and people in the anti-war movement knew to be true all along. It was not a mistake of judgment. It was a war of aggression against another country that killed probably 1 million people, which is, I'm sorry, Hitler level evil.
Yes.
Shit.
Yes.
So, like, if you can, once you admit that to yourself, like, there's no follow through on, like, the moral or political ramifications of
Absolutely.
It whatsoever.
Yes. And we obviously, like, the occupation in particular, the invasion was relatively swift. And I'm not talking morally here. I'm just talking about the competence of the American empire. The invasion was relatively swift. There actually were some fuck ups there as well. But the occupation, and everything that came after that is what I think most people think of as the incompetence and the bungling and all that. And there is bungling and there is incompetence. We don't want to short sell that. But in largely speaking, the policies were deliberate and the carnage that they brought about were deliberate. It wasn't as though, you know, because the way George W. Bush gets, he's basically Frank Drebin now. You know, he's like a lovable oaf who goes on Ellen and, you know, he's, you know, I don't know what happened back then. It wasn't great, but his heart's in the right place. And who cares or even remembers now? That's a major motivating factor for us to do the show in the first place. But these policies were deliberate. And so, you know, there are funny things. We want this to be like the, I don't know, Cohen or Safdie brothers retelling of the Iraq War. We want to get into all the corruption and all the weird absurdity of it, but we also want to, you know, much as you guys do still on this show, mix the highbrow and the lowbrow, the funny and the depraved. So you have things like in the occupation, you know, Paul Bremer, the viceroy of Iraq, to Iraq's spiritual leader of the Shia community, this Ayatollah, the envoy he sent was not a religious scholar or any kind of fellow imam himself, but a dick doctor who had patented a bunch of penile implant technologies could speak Arabic. That was our envoy to this, to the main guy of the Shiite community.
We were hoping he would make his hog big.
Yeah, I mean, maybe that was the message. Yeah. I don't know. But then we have, all of the worst people's kids in the Republican, you know, administration getting jobs, like designing the new urban planning of Iraq, writing the constitution, you know, to these like 18 and 19 and 20-year-old gophers.
Like Heritage Foundation interns.
Mark Levin's kid.
The radio guy?
Yes. Yeah.
Mark Levin's kid got a job.
Wait, let me make sure that I'm getting it right. No, what? There's another one. There's another Mark, isn't there?
Savage?
No, it's Mark Levin.
It is Mark Levin.
And Paul Bremer was obviously this, you know, dandy who put combat boots, you know, on his underneath his Brooks Brothers suit. And people were fucking in the porta potties, you know, in the green zone. It was a farce, but it was also a incredibly world historical, like civilization destroying farce, and we try to talk about that as well. So, and I actually, by the way, I have here the I brought a prop. This is the card deck.
Iraq's Most Wanted. This is the deck
the
of
playing cards when we were
that
going
they gave
in.
Every enlisted man so as that they could and familiarize themselves with the high value targets of the Saddam regime.
These were the top Ba'ath Party guys.
Yes. Let's see, six of hearts here. Muhammad Mahdi Al Salah, Minister of Trade.
Yep. Saddam is obviously the ace.
We could do like an Animal House style thing. Where they are they now?
Yeah.
Animal House. Let's see, house.
King of Diamonds. Let's see. Aziz Salih Al Numan, Ba'ath Party Regional Command Chairman, responsible for West Baghdad.
Yep.
He sort of looks like Christopher Plummer, kind of.
Sure. Yeah. The casting.
Give me one of these. I want to find out what happened to
around.
These guys.
Okay. Let's,
give me a guy.
Five of clubs. Let's see here. We've got Barzan Ibrahim Hassan Altakriti. He's just a presidential advisor.
We hit almost none of these guys going in, by the way. There were like all these strikes or whatever in the initial invasion to try and decapitate the leadership, so called.
That Barzan guy got executed in 2007.
Right. I think slowly but surely, this deck was probably like the human faces on this deck were liquefied. But most of the time during the invasion, we just took out a shitload of civilians.
Oh, my God. This is I'm glad I looked this guy up. So that guy you randomly said to Creedy. So yeah. He was executed in 2007 along with his co-defendants, Saddam and former. So he was executed as part of the Saddam trial.
Right. There were two other guys.
And
with
the former
Saddam.
Chief Justice of the Revolutionary Court. When he was hanged, he was accidentally decapitated. Because the rope was too long.
First time.
Yeah, and the a lot of the guys were named Tikriti because Saddam comes from the village or near the town of Tikrit. And so I think a lot of the guys' last names on the deck there are Tikriti, quote unquote, last names. But yeah, and we get into the Saddam lore, you know, his family. We get into a lot of the first episode is actually all about the 20th century history.
Yeah, you know, it's sort of about like it's the connective tissue, I think, to kind of explain like how America meddled in the middle of the 20th century and why we did it. And like it makes very, very clear how we would then become friends with Saddam in like the 70s and 80s. And then why we would turn on Saddam before like destroying Saddam, his government and
as far back as the 60s, the Ba'ath Party, you know, was like the hot new nationalists. Cell inside of Iraq, and Saddam was joining it right around the time the Iraqis had a revolution in the 50s. But by 63, the CIA very, very, very likely was at least involved in his party's installation. They fell out of power for a little bit, but then they stuck the landing in 68.
What were they hedging against in installing them in the first place?
Would you be surprised to know it was communism?
Oh, okay. All right. This rhymes.
Our first episode is a lot of Cold War politics. And, you know, we start with the British, obviously, but we move on from them pretty quickly to the Americans taking over. And it's a lot of Cold War politicking. And the Soviets came to the West a couple times in the late 50s and said, hey, how about none of us intervene in the Middle East anymore? It's going to get real messy. It's probably a bad idea. We can work this shit out diplomatically. They wanted to draw down all bases, all foreign troops, and arms embargo to everybody. And the U.S. said, to quote Dr. Evil, how about no? And we ratcheted up every single possible way to play against the Soviets in Iraq in particular, and that was giving comfort and materiel and intelligence and perhaps even, you know, the ascension to power of the Ba'ath Party, which would, of course, introduce the career of Saddam Hussein.
And, you know, and then when, you know, our enemy changed a bit, when our rivalry with the Soviet Union wasn't enough of an activity or a pastime for American empire, and we began working against the Islamic Republic of Iran, we then teamed up with the Iraqi government to wage war there as well. In what, you know, was the longest protracted sustained conflict, you know, it was the longest, what
conventional,
what was the
yeah.
longest quote unquote, you know, conventional war of the 20th century. And, you know, we get into this in a bit more detail on our show, but I mean, we literally gave them the Iraqi military the coordinates to conduct chemical attacks.
And we sold them anthrax.
And then just a few years before we initiated the Gulf War.
Yep.
So we, you know, there's a lot that happens there, but I think that, you know, I think one of the things that I feel pretty strongly about with this show is that those sorts of pieces of the story are so essential to understanding a lot of why we were there in the first place and why a lot of these really powerful people would want to have amnesia about it. Because it's, you know, it's not just like it's an atrocity that we committed in the mid-2000s, but it's part of like an entire like rotted, fucked up scissors. It's part of an entire rotted, fucked up system of which they're all like key players.
One thing I'm really hoping people can get from the show, especially early on, is episode two, is that the sanctions in the 90s and the Gulf War were as big of a crime, actually, as the Iraq War itself. It killed probably around the same amount of people, and it immiserated the country in a way that we really had never actually done to someone else before. Bit of a tonal shift, though. Did you know that Saddam was once given the key to the city of Detroit?
Really? What for?
Yes. There was a Chaldean church. And it was the first year of his presidency, if I'm not mistaken. It was 1979. And he had sent money to this church in Detroit. And they got the mayor to give them the key to the city. And they went over as like a delegation from America to the Republican Palace and said, thank you so much for supporting Christian minorities, maybe in the Middle East, and then also us in America. And he said, oh, yeah, no problem. Do you guys need any more money? And they said, actually, we do. And he said, here's another check. And he gave them $250,000. And I don't know if like the key was prominently displayed in the Republican Palace, but that's how close
The Motor City Bathman.
Yeah. There he is. But yeah, so there's a lot of stuff. We're it's a little ambitious, maybe over ambitious. We try to go from, you know, the first episode is all that kind of backstory, and then we take it till about ISIS, you know.
Yeah,
the last episode ends around there.
Yeah.
All right. Well, just to wrap this up and, like, you know, bring it back to the present and, like, our current political catastrophe that we're dealing with.
Our fucking un-fuck-crustable sack catastrophe.
It goes back to this idea that, like, the Iraq War was something that was supported by every single, like, major institution of American, like, intellectual, political, and media power, so, with very few exceptions, across the board, from liberal to conservative.
Even some sections of the left, like the kind of liberal left.
The Hitchens Descent or whatever.
The yeah. quote, no, I mean, like, Dissent Magazine.
Dissent Magazine, yeah.
Michael Walzer, yeah. So, yes, it was unilateral.
Now we all realize, oh, our bad, that was a mistake. But every single person who helped this happen, and by that I mean, like, either advocated for it in the forms of, like, op-eds or, like, wrote disingenuous news articles that stovepiped phony intelligence directly to the American public.
That's the episode Will is on for everybody who's going to listen. Will comes on to talk about the media.
Every single one of these people are still on your TV, not only just telling you what should happen as far as America's role in the world or what our foreign policy should be, but even more than that, hectoring you, like making a moral argument for why you should still continue to listen to them.
Yep.
And, like, first of all, there was no one ever on TV or in any op-ed page who was against it who could, you know, be on your TV now, because they never were. But it's just like, how do we begin to, like, deal with the fact that all of these people are not just still with us, but have been, like, promoted. And my favorite example, Jennifer Rubin was one of the most, like, hawkish neocon ghouls.
Sure.
One of the most right-wing voices in the Washington Post for years, for, like, two decades almost, has now totally come back and rebranded herself as, like, the Democratic Party whisperer.
Yep.
And she is out there on TV and in print almost every day, with the expectation that you, as a Democratic voter, take her advice seriously on what the Democratic Party should do and how they should behave and what they should advocate for. I don't know. Like, I guess, like, I don't know. I don't have an answer. This is a rhetorical question. I just don't know what to make of that or what to do with that.
No, I think looking at it square in the face is one of those things that'll sober you up about what America is really capable of and what it's really about. I mean, you mentioned Jennifer Rubin, David Frum, a lot of these administration people or their sympathizers in the media. Also in the military, this one general named Spider Marks, who was on the ground discovering there was no WMD, he almost comes across as sympathetic in some of the accounts, not, you know, in a very limited sense as far as someone who was like, this was bullshit. But I saw a clip of him on TV when the Soleimani stuff happened. He was all about banging the war drum against Iran. So
James Woolsey,
former CIA director.
He was the former CIA director under Clinton briefly in the 90s. And, you know, like on TV in the hours after 9/11, basically, he's already pointing the finger at Iraq. And Woolsey was, like, the first and most high profile, like, intelligence community person to endorse Trump in 2016.
Yep.
And he's been, like, part of, like, you know, like the Trumpist, like, inner circle now. And, like, it's like these people haven't gone away. It's they're like herpes.
John Bolton is resistance now because he has a book out or whatever.
Yeah.
They're all still here. And I think if you really want to understand the rot and then get angry about it and then channel it into the political will necessary, you have to look at shit like the
Iraq War. But also, like, if you think about, like, the rise of what would eventually become, like, Chapo or, like, podcasts or, like, social
media. Really important.
Like, you know, yeah. No, but I mean, like in the Bush administration, like, that was, like, the rise of, like, the blogosphere.
Sure.
And, like, you know, like, Daily Kos. Like, that was, like, the new, like a resurgent, like, left. They were like, we're outside the mainstream. Like, yeah. You know, we are, like, you know, the people yelling from the street into the party going, like, you're all mad. This is crazy.
Yeah.
And throughout the entire Bush administration, like, if you were against the war in Iraq in the Bush administration, like, that was it.
Yeah.
That was, like, the leftmost possibility. And then as soon as Barack Obama got in, like, all those differences that were totally flattened by it, we've revealed that how almost all of those people were totally full of shit, too.
Yep.
Case in point, how eager they are to support Joe Biden, yep. the guy who, again, did this thing. He did it. He's just as responsible as George W. Bush.
Yep.
I mean, I know George W. Bush like spearheaded it. That was his idea. But Joe Biden and everyone like him in the Democratic Party, but him especially, is every bit as culpable as Dick Cheney.
Yep.
Every fucking bit as culpable. And now these people are getting ready to scold you into fucking voting for him again.
Yep. Don't do it.
Don't do it.
We're going to do it. He's going to be president.
Yeah.
He's going to be some sort of ventriloquist dummy. They're just going to like literally hollow him out.
Who's the guy, Salazar?
Salazar.
They told him he's still president.
In Portugal. Yeah. He had a stroke and all of his minions were scrambling to create a continuity of government, assuming he was going to die. And then he got better, but they moved on.
Yeah.
And so they kind of wept for the rest of his life. Pretended to him that he was still in charge.
Yes.
That's basically going to be Biden.
That's going to be Biden.
Yeah. Just a few little things that happened while we were recording. Mike DeWine, governor of Ohio, has postponed the Ohio primary until June.
Okay.
They're going to do, like, I think, just mail-in votes until and then mm-hmm. until that deadline.
Mm-hmm. He's still a Republican. That would seem to be the responsible thing
to do. Well, that's the thing. Only the only states that are likely to do it are Republican-run states. Yeah. Democrat-run states want them.
The death cult is death culting.
Yeah. In all of its different manifestations. I mean, we're seeing, like, this is just this whole thing is a fucking is a tesseract of death cultery of every emanation of capitalism driving towards the only thing to the only way to respond to a significant crisis that could kill millions of people is to just drive into the skid and kill as many as possible, because anything else would disrupt things, would disrupt profit flows or would disrupt power structures, and that can't happen. So we'll sacrifice millions on the fucking altar of something as stupid as getting a few more fucking delegates for Joe fucking Biden. The other thing is the Dow closed down 3,000 points, all-time single day drop record.
Okay.
All that quantitative easing is really doing the work.
All because we showed up to do a promo today. on that note, I should say again, thanks for having us on. We hope everyone enjoys this new show. It's called Blowback.
Got nothing but time to listen to it.
Yeah. I mean, if you're quarantining, there's 10 hours with the bonus giveaway that Chapo is kindly putting up today or tonight when you're hearing this. It's called Blowback. Again, if you want a month free of Stitcher Premium, where the show is going to be for a while, just go to stitcherpremium.com, promo code Blowback, and we hope you listen and enjoy.
And, you know, if you're listening at home and you're quarantined and you're seeing everything fall apart and you're wondering how can we deal with this given the failure of our institutions and electoral politics, a lot of people talk about dual power. You know, I don't know really how much capacity we have for that, but if you're looking at the Iraq War, Mahdi Army.
Yeah.
Good example.
It's a model.
A good little model, you know.
And he's still around.
He is.
Mukhtar's still around.
Now he is one of the most powerful politicians in Iraq.
Yep. You'll meet all the stars.
All the stars are there.
So once again, I'd like to thank Noah and Brendan. The show is Blowback, and you will be getting just a little taster, a little test bag to spike up with.
And for more information on the show, and if you want to, like, you know, check out some of the sources that we've used and so on, our website is blowback.show. And then on Twitter, our handle is @blowbackpod.
I wonder what blowback.org is.
All right. Till next time, we'll be back later in the week for part two of our hyper jokerification. Oh, we are watching episodes 3 and 4 of the Hillary Clinton docuseries on Hulu.
Woo! Well, I'll be doing it while wearing Venetian plague masks.
the big reveal on episode 4, she's patient zero of coronavirus.
Cheers, guys.
Bye.
Bye.
This land is your land. This land is my land. I'm a Texas tiger. You're a liberal wiener. I'm a great crusader. You're a Herman Munster. This land will surely vote for me.
This land is your land. This land is my land. I'm an intellectual. You're a stupid dumbass. I'm a Purple Heart winner. And yes, it's true, I won it thrice. This land will surely vote for me.
You have more waffles than a house of pancakes. You offer flip-flops, I offer tax breaks. You're a UN pussy, and yes, it's true that I kick ass. Ha! This land will surely vote for me.
You can't say nuclear, that really scares me. Sometimes a brain can come in quite handy, but it's not gonna help you, because I won 3 Purple Hearts. This land will surely vote for me.
You're a liberal sissy.
You're a right-wing nut job.
You're a pinko commie.
You're dumb as a doorknob.
Hey, you got that Botox.
But I still won 3 Purple Hearts.
This land will surely vote for me.
This land was my land.
But now it's our land.
From California to the New York Isle. What'd I do?
From the liberal wieners
to the right-wing nut jobs.
This land belongs.
This land belongs.
This land belongs to you and me.
Yeah. Oh, and Dick Cheney, too.